I just wanted to turn to something that hasn't been not really discussed so much in our purport, but is the thing we encounter a great deal in our preaching, and namely, when we say the absolute truth is a person, and we talk about the person the absolute truth is, we have something in mind that's very concrete and very specific, huh? Such as described in the Brahma Samhita, Venum Kwanandam Aravindam Dalaya Daksham. He's playing a flute, wears a peacock feathers on his head. Shyamam Tribhanga, his color is dark blue. He stands in a particular way, so his body is bent in three places. He herds cows, that's his occupation. Boats built with spiritual gems, surrounded by everything's very concrete, specific. And this is something of a people in the West, when they hear about this or see about this, they immediately think, here's something that's symbolic. That these expressions they want to say do not literally apply to the absolute truth, but they must apply in some symbolic way, whereas, which means you use this language, but ultimately you don't believe in it. And the big shock to people when they come to Krishna consciousness is that people believe in it. They have a commitment to this language that most people in Western religious traditions, and also in the Mayavadi traditions, ultimately get rid of. And so why is it a shock, and why does it happen? Well, of course, you might think that in the West it's a little when we say God is a person, and then people from Christian tradition say, oh, we believe that too. We believe that God is a person. And then when you find out what they mean by person, they're still upset. They don't, the notion that he has, for example, a form, a human form, a body, they're shocked by that. And the notion is that he may be a person, but he's a kind of, ghostly sort of person, or abstract sort of person. In the early part of the century, the philosopher and psychologist William James was giving a lecture to a bunch of Unitarian ministers. And in the course of a lecture, he just wanted a kind of definition of God to reach for. And one, he said that we all believe, he said, without any argument, don't have to argue for it, means, of course, everyone knows this. He said, is that God is, he says, a mental personality. A mental personality. Why just a mental personality? But that's the notion. Well, because you want to get away from bodies, maybe. This is, of course, late Victorian thinking, and people were already a little... People are mortified, actually, by being in material bodies. They've got so many problems attached to them, and you want to, to protect the dignity of God, you have to get him away from something so gross as bodies. And William James is a professor, and all these Unitarian ministers, they were sort of cerebral guys, and they thought, the mental life is higher and more dispassionate and more respectable than being in bodies.
Isn't harmlessness a factor?
Huh?
Harmless. I mean, the mental is harmless.
Mental is harmless. Well, I don't know. Sometimes it's pretty vicious fight in there in the mental realms. Anyway, perhaps they had different ideas. But there's this notion. But the notion is, common notion is that when you think about God, you move in the direction away from what is concrete and particular and sensible, that is to say, apparent to your senses, to things that are more abstract. and less apparent to the senses. From gross to subtle. And we just discussed earlier, I think, that hierarchy of gross to subtle, from earth to the more subtle elements like space and then mind. So people actually, speculative thought, when it tends to think of spirit, you know, goes in this direction, and you want to gradually evacuate your concepts of all concreteness and all particularity. For example, look at the speculations of Plato. You start with the world of senses, and you see that there are many particular things. There are many cows, and they come in different shapes and sizes and colors and so on. But we call all of them cows, right? Plato thinks something like this. We call all of them cows. Well, why is that? What is it that obviously they all share in some essence, some essential nature, which is cowness, right? So Plato postulated that if you have all these particular concrete cows with proper names and a numerical variety of them, all these different cows here, they all participated in something called, you know, cowness, which really existed outside the realm, in a kind of ideal realm, which was, the Greek word is eidon, which is translated as idea or form. But it's not a form like we mean with a shape. It's just cowness, the abstract essence of cows. You know, you can't milk it. you can't hurt it. But it's there, this eidon, right? And so, according to Plato, there was a whole world of ideal types, right? Because there was cows, there was human beings, there was this, that was other, right? So you had this whole thing where you lack individual in particular. What are these ideas? They're mental entities, aren't they? Huh? I mean, a cowness is something that's perceived in the mind, not merely with the senses. When you think about, when you use the word cow, you're not thinking about any particular cow, are you? You're thinking about just any cow. Or cowness. So already, you see, we're on the mental platform, so to speak. You know, this mental level of mental things. So now you've got the realm of ideas. Then one notices there's still a plurality. And what do all these ideas have in common? Well, they're all ideas. So they also participate and derive their existence from a higher level, the ultimate being called the form of forms, or the idea of ideas. This is the Param Satyam. So you're just, by a gradual process of abstraction, because these, he says, are more real than these. Because these come and go. Just a minute. These come and go. Individual cows are born and die, but cowness is eternal. And then again, to solve the problem of where do these come from, and what are the essence that these have in common, there's this. So this is actually the source. So as you go from gross to subtle, you go from what is less real to what is more real. But gradually, you see, also you're becoming more abstract. This is an abstraction of abstractions. The form of the good. That's Plato's kind of speculative way of getting at the absolute truth. This does correspond to something in Vedic thought. You know what it is?
Living entities and supreme.
No. These aren't individual living entities. These are ideas. They're abstract.
Ecology of, like, earth, air, fire.
No. Those are deaths down here. What it is, actually, is the Vedas. The Vedas are actually have the blueprints, or the archetypical forms of all the types of living entities in the material world. This is the realm of the Vedas, is the closest correspondence I can see. People sometimes think of Plato's idea world as analogous to, say, Goloka Vrindavan. But it's not, because there are individual cows there. There's not a, you know, ideal type of a cow. There's lots of cows, each of them with proper names. You've gone beyond this. This is the impersonal Brahman. By his process of abstraction, also involving renunciation as a spiritual practice, somehow or other, Plato was able to get some kind of realization of the level of impersonal Brahman by going up this way. Did you, Ian?
Yeah, did Plato consider those, how do you pronounce it, Aidan?
Aidan, yeah.
Aidan as simply mental constructs, or did he give them...
No, they were out there real. Yeah, they were out there real. It was Aristotle who said, you know, come on, there's... Then there became a big debate in philosophy. Realism, which says these things exist, and nominalism, which says they're made up human constructions. That goes on for, you know, a couple of 1,000 years or so. It's still going on. But anyway, he thought, no, they're real. And they possess, Neoplatonism, these possess, you know, potency, and they create their instantiations within the material world. It all flows out and flows back again, you know. Just goes out and sucks back up. Like that. I don't want to get into this too much, because this is like a whole technical subject. But I just want to give you this note. This is what we are accustomed to in the West. That another way where we also... is just this very notion of the incompetence of our language. You see, also language starts to fail you, you know, as you go up this ladder. Or just in general, people say, like this, theologians, they reason like this. Our language is made and comes about through our traffic with sense objects in the material world. It's embedded in the material world. When we start to use our language to describe transcendence, or what is beyond our experience, obviously our language fails. It can't quite work. And really, when we start to describe the absolute truth, where all things come to be the ultimate unity of everything, then language has to stop. Our language is used in the relative world. Now we're talking about the absolute world. Huh? So the best thing that you can say is silence. That's the most accurate, you know. This is all, everywhere, this is like street Buddhism, you know. They all like to go back to some big revelation of Buddha where he just smiled and held up a flower, you know, and that was the ultimate speech.
There's also the fifth aphorism of the Danta Sutra.
Ikshate na ashabdam?
Yeah.
That counteracts that in Vedanta Sutra. Ikshate na adi. Absolute truth is not inexpressible by words. Na ashabdam.
I misunderstood.
Yeah, no, it doesn't say it's Ikshate na ashabdam. It's not ashabdam, not indescribable by words. Vedanta Sutra says opposite, but...
Sanskrit words.
Huh?
Sanskrit is a transcendental language, so it's not that Sanskrit could be used to describe it.
Yeah, well, see, our philosophy of language is a little different. They want to say, you know, that our language is rooted in this world, and we stretch it to reach the absolute. It breaks, you know, like a rubber band that's gone too far, and all you can do is say, silence, you know. Thomas Aquinas says, for example, he says this in Summa Theologica, he says, the more abstract the terms are, the more properly they pertain to God. That's there in black and white. That's what he says. The more abstract the terms are, the more properly they pertain to God. Abstract means less worldly, less, you know. So you have this is the speculative traditions ends up in this way, in silence or something that's very close to it. Or you can't say even that God is good, for example. Good means in contrast to evil, but God is obviously in the absolute realm. There's no contrast between good and evil, so he's beyond that duality, so you can't really say good either. You might as well say evil if you're going to say good for all that. And so really, the wise know God cannot be spoken about. And so there's these naively faithful people. They go to church and everything. They worship God and they sing hymns. But that's for people on a lower level. Those of us who are on the higher level, you know, we know that you cannot say anything. This is the kind of standard way of things. So then you come along with this, you know, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu, blue cowherd boy, and so on. That he has a form, that he's a person. All this stuff strikes people as very strange. Well, first of all, we can see that the process of negation is incomplete. Here you're going to describe what is the greatest of all, and you end up with a big zero. Because if you describe the absolute truth simply by negation, no name, no form, no quality, no relationships, how does that differ from nothing at all? You may say God, but really, you've got nothing. And mystic theology will talk like that. The divine non-being, they will say. You know, as though you've got something spectacular. But it's nothing. It's a big zero. It's inadequate. Prabhupada has an argument against negation. He says, you're trying to define the absolute by negations. But these negations are the opposites of that which they are negating. So they're also relative. You're trying to get a conception of something that is absolute or not related to anything else, right? So I say, here's all these material forms. So that's relative. So the transcendence must be no form. The absolute must have no form. But the idea of form depends upon, the idea of no form depends upon the idea of form. So still you've got an opposite, you're still in the material world, you've still got an opposite of something else. So your form and formless, your formlessness is also a material conception of the Supreme. So in this way you can see that it's incomplete. So the actual situation, if you want to know the truth, is you see these speculative attempts to define, by speculation to define the absolute, they come to some kind of you start with the plurality and the diversity of this material world, and by speculation you come up to this point where your thoughts cannot proceed anymore, a singularity, you know, where everything comes to a stop. There's some ineffable unity from which everything proceeds. This is a common experience of the mystics. Now, what they do not know, because of the limitations of their method of going up, is that the whole thing keeps going. And this is just a boundary line. And they get up to this boundary line, and this is what they report. What we have from the Vedas is all this. This figure is described, I've done a little abstractly, but it's described basically as a tree in the Bhagavad Gita. There's a tree with its roots upwards and its branches downward. And that's the reflection of the real tree. So this is where this comes from. So we go further. You come from this. Here is the impersonal Brahman, which is like a singularity here. And as you go, where all your everything goes, all your instruments go haywire, where your language stops functioning. But if you can go beyond, then there's this other realm of this notion here, transcendental variegatedness. Not the variegatedness of the material world, but this transcendental variegatedness. Venum quanandam aravindam dalaya daksham barhavatam smasitam buddhasundarangam kandarpakotika. That's described there. That's our proposal. And because you cannot give what you have not got, the fact that this has shape and form and properties and individuality here also indicates that all these things are here, but in some super excellent fashion, which is not really comprehensible by the contaminated minds in this place. It is a fact. Atasi Krishna Namadi Namaved Grayam Indriyai. It is a fact that our materially contaminated senses cannot grasp the name, form, qualities, etc. of Krishna. In that sense, all the where it always says that you know, words fail, language stops. That to in some respects, it is very true. Your mundane language, it won't reach up. It won't go. So, as David said, that the language we use is, in fact, not mundane. That's what we have to say. When we are given, in, say, the Brahma Samhita, which describes Krishna, and so on, or even just take something to another, they all fold just out of those syllables, because it's those Krishna and Krishna's name are the same. Abhinatvat nama naminaho. So that mantra is not a product. It doesn't come from down here. It's not formed by our commerce with the material world. Where does our language come from? Janmadasyataha. It comes from the absolute truth. And that the original function of our language is to glorify Krishna. So the philosophers have this notion of describing God as something like, they call it analogical predication. Huh? Nice, huh? Analogical predication. That says, well, here our language is, you know, used here in the material world, and we apply it to God to say he's something like that. Something like good, something like great, something like all these things that we have. So that really it's not to be taken literally. It's not to be taken literally. When it says God is my father or anything like that, not really literally to be taken, but something of that relationship is there. You ever sit and talk to some like a Christian priest or something, you know, and push him on this, what does it really mean? He'll say, you know, he has no idea. Because he starts to think about the meaning of all these terms, and that's why they start to play around with it all the time. They think they can change it around because it's really all a concoction. You know, that there's no real authority for any of it because it's all made up by us. So, but here, what we see is they want to say you start here and you go up. Actually, here's the original meaning of the terms. And by analogy, somehow or other, they're used down here. The real meaning of, say, dark blue, Shyama, that refers to Krishna. And by some kind of analogy, it's used to refer to things of this material world. So the literal meaning of the words about Krishna apply here. That's the literal meaning. So if someone wants to say, do you believe that Krishna's literally a blue cowherd boy? We can say yes. But until we have purified vision, we can't say exactly what that means. Because when we see Krishna, it'll be nothing like you imagine. You'll see, oh yes, he is. He's a blue cowherd boy, but like you've never seen a blue cowherd boy like that. But it doesn't mean that we give up this language. That's the Mayavadi speculation is you give up the language on the basis that really it's all a concoction and the truth is somewhere here. That's as far as they get. What we have is given from here. Naturally, there's some resemblance, but this is the original thing. Yeah.
One thing I like to use from the Bible, and I'm wondering how is a description of the revelations of the Lord's form, which is actually very beautiful, and sitting on the throne, and with Jesus sitting on his right hand.
Yeah.
So how do they deal with that?
They say it's symbolic. Others say it's symbolic.
Most of the people buy it as it is.
They'll do that because most people will. But you have to talk to somebody, you know, who's got an education. They'll tell you it's symbolic. Only what they used to call in my religion department is naive believers. In other words, people who don't have educations, they tend to be working class, so on. They take it literally. They take it literally. They expect to see a big throne up there, 80 feet high. It says in the Bible that God walked in the garden of the cool of the evening. Go to any rabbi and say, here it says, he has a form, he walked in the cool of the evening, and they'll show you all the commentaries that says it's symbolic. All kinds of places. It says to them, when Moses was on Mount Sinai, he couldn't see the face of God, he could only see his backside. That, you know, God had a face and a backside. But they don't accept it. That's right. That's right. Sometimes it's better off. You're better off.
Huh? And this tree picture was a reflection of the tree. The things on the leaves of the tree facing down, of the leaves of the upside down tree are the highest things in the spiritual tree.
Yeah.
So the individual instances of things are the most exalted things.
Yeah, in the spiritual world. Right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how close you want to put this, but all Prabhupada says about here that sometimes what is highest in the spiritual world appears as what is lowest in the material world. He had an example. The highest thing in the spiritual world is the Parakīya rasa of the gopis, which is in the conjugal love in the mood of an adulterous relationship. Of course, there's no real adulterous relationship. They all belong to Krishna. But still, that mood is there. But that becomes reflected in what is something very low in the material world. Yeah.
We call the highest things basic.
Hmm?
We call the highest things basic.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's okay. Now, one thing we should understand is this idea of a person. Let me just give you a few. That's been very nicely described by Prabhupada, what it means by person. He says, to say that the Absolute is a person is to say that the Absolute has senses. It's a very interesting person. In other words, we have senses. Senses are instruments. As you know, in the Vedic analysis of senses, there's two kinds of senses. Senses for perceiving the world, sound, touch, taste, smell, hearing, the sense of hearing and taste and touch, seeing. And also the hands, the legs, senses for acting back on the world, these instruments for acting back on the world. They're called the karmendriya, or active senses, or active instruments. Instruments for manipulation, instruments for locomotion, instruments for sound production, instruments for reproduction, instruments for evacuation. These are called the five karmendriya. So if you take all the instruments by which we act back on the world, and the gyanendriya, the knowledge acquiring senses by which the world acts upon us, we can see that what a body is, what we mean by body, is an organized array of instruments or sense organs. So it follows that if the Absolute Truth is a person means has senses, then it follows has form or a body. That's what we mean by person. Interesting notion, this instrument. It means that therefore there has to be, if there's senses, then there's sense objects. That means there's an environment. And that's one reason why it is denied that God is a person. Because it makes him one among many. You know, there's an environment. Here's Krishna, and here's Krishna's environment. Limited. But God is unlimited. How can he have an environment? See here, here's my, you know, the environment begins here, and this is my form means limitation. God has no limitation, therefore he has no form. That's the common notion. But of course, if he has no form, that's also a limitation, not to have form. There was a film a while ago while George Burns showed up smoking a cigar and playing God. I heard about it, I didn't see it. And somebody was astonished to see him, you know, as a human being. He says, "You think I'm just a cloud of gas?" He says. Well, he's not George Burns either. He's definitely not a cloud of gas. So, not to have a form is also a limitation. So Krishna has form. But at the same time, he has this environment. But what is this environment? It is his own energy. It is his own potency that creates that environment. So in one sense, he's everything. All that there is Krishna and Krishna's energy that exhausts the ontology. Right? So he is one without a second, that besides which there is no other. If you take it all, him all together, it's Krishna and Krishna's energies, which is the whole picture. So still he's not limited, even though he has his environment and other living entities with whom he interacts. If he doesn't have those things, if he can't play, what a limitation that is. If he can't have relationships, I mean, all these things that are wonderful things, glorious things, all of a sudden he wants to be deprived of them. Mostly because in the material world, we've tried to do these things independently of Krishna, like have relationships and become such sourpusses about the whole enterprise that we think, you know, God would never get involved in this kind of stuff. But he has them in an exemplary fashion. His relationships are not undercut with all the problems that we have. Because when we try to form relationships without Krishna's being involved, then they all are give us problems. And therefore, when people want transcendence, they don't want relationships. In fact, they're going into spiritual life just to get away from people. They want the ultimate isolation. That's what they're looking for. So they become afraid, Prabhupada says, of the idea of individual personal existence. They hate themselves. They hate themselves and they hate everybody else because of their horrible experiences in the material world. So you tell them God is a person, that's the last thing they want to hear. That's the part of the pathology that leads to these impersonal ideas. Any other questions? Yeah?
Last night in the Lecture Devotion course, we heard about the reference to the verse that we're doing in regard to how everything is in this verse, including all the way up to the conjugal rocks. I wonder if you could.
Everything is in this verse?
Yeah,
Yeah, Prabhupada explains that in the purport.
Are done, which actually
unfold the interior meaning of the verse. Yeah. Yeah, well, Prabhupada does it, right? He mentions this. It's not, you know, it's not, what do you have to say? It's not explicit, it's implicit. And what he says is this word dhimahi, param satyam dhimahi, that's like being initiated. And then when you become initiated, then you can understand these things. So there won't be any explicit reference, but that dhamna, his all transcendental paraphernalia. Then satyam param dimahi, that all the rasas are in there. That's why Prabhupada puts the comments in here about adiras is in here because of this dhamna swena sadana rasta kuhakam satyam param dimahi. Anything else here?
How are we to understand the power of this verse? What's willing to say? I made a vow to chant it for the next few years every day. Should you get a like that?
Yeah, sure.
Because everything's there. Right?
Yeah, there's certain words that pack a lot. You know, like the Hare Krishna mantra. Or for example, what we call Mula Mantras. Om, Kleem. Shrim, Ram, Shraum. All kinds of things evolve out of these words.
So the last line of the verse, it has Kuhakam Satyam Param.
Dimahi.
Is that kind of Om embedded in the end of each verse?
No. Om is, that starts with Om. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudeva. It starts with Om and ends with Dimahi. And what happens is, with that, as he says with the Dimahi, it indicates the process of initiation into the Gayatri Mantra. So that whole process, if you really, you know, if you want to study this verse and understand it, you also have to go through the processes of purification, which open up more and more of its meanings. Prabhupada said, you know, that everything about Krishna, it's just like we study about Krishna, that each limb of his body contains all the potencies of the whole person. Every sense can perform the function. This is this holistic feature of the absolute truth, like a hologram. You know, the whole thing is in every part. So that's true about Srimad Bhagavatam too. That's true about Srimad Bhagavatam. So you can take, Prabhupada says about Srimad Bhagavatam, if a person reads one line, one word, his life will be changed. Because actually it's in there, even if you don't realize it. But then when you become to realize it more and more, then Krishna directly appears, he says, in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. If Srimad Bhagavatam is heard with proper attention. But it cannot be heard with proper attention unless one is pure in mind. And one cannot be pure in mind unless one is pure in all the activities of life, even the basic eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. When one's life is entirely pure, then the mind becomes pure, then it can concentrate properly on Srimad Bhagavatam, and then Krishna is fully manifest directly in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah?
Can it really be as easy as it says in the purport that if you give away a Srimad Bhagavatam on a full moon, you go back to Godhead?
Try it. Yeah, you definitely should. If you give it away anytime, actually. How fast is another question. But that you'll go back, that's fixed up. Okay, thank you very much.